This episode of The Trail Went Cold is brought to you by Murderbook, a new true crime podcast hosted by best-selling author Michael Connelly, available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Also be sure to check out Dark Sacred Night, Michael Connelly's latest number one bestseller featuring detectives Harry Bosch and Renee Ballard. Thank you, and enjoy the show. February 11th, 1979. Hana, Hawaii. Five men, Scott Mormon, Peter Hanchett, Benjamin Kalama, Patrick Woosner, and Ralph Malayakini, leave the island of Maui on a fishing trip on a boat named the Sarah Jo. When a violent storm hits the area, the Sarah Jo and its crew do not return, and an extensive search effort fails to find them. 9.5 years later, the Sarah Jo is discovered over 2,300 miles away on a remote atoll in the Marshall Islands. A marked grave containing the skeletal remains of Scott Mormon is found nearby, but no trace of the other four missing men is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering a unique mystery involving a missing boat, the 1979 disappearance of the Sarah Jo. This story became famous after it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and I've got numerous requests to cover this one since the inception of the podcast. Since its 40th anniversary just passed last month, I thought this would be an appropriate time to finally do an episode. Anyway, this case involves five men from the Hawaiian island of Maui who set off on a fishing trip on a boat named the Sarah Jo. When a terrible storm hit the area, the boat never returned, and under normal circumstances, this probably wouldn't be much of a mystery. But things got a lot more complicated nearly a decade later when the boat's wreckage, along with a marked grave containing the remains of one of the missing men, was discovered on an uninhabited atoll over 2,000 miles away, which raised a number of perplexing questions. What happened to the other four men? Did they actually make it to the atoll alive before burying their friend? How come neither the boat nor the grave was found during a previous expedition to the atoll years earlier? Well, these are just a few of the questions we are going to attempt to answer on this week's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the bizarre saga of the Sarah Jo. Our story begins in 1979 on the Hawaiian island of Maui, and there are five central figures: 27-year-old Scott Mormon, 31-year-old Peter Hanchett, 38-year-old Benjamin Kalama, 26-year-old Patrick Woosner, and 27-year-old Ralph Malayakini. While most of these men were born on the island, Scott Mormon originally hailed from California's San Fernando Valley and had a fascination with Hawaii since childhood. During the mid-1970s, Mormon got married and had a son, but when the marriage came to an end, Mormon finally decided to take the plunge and move to Maui, where he settled in the small community of Nahiku, located on the eastern side of the island. When Mormon returned to California for his son's birthday, he took the opportunity to visit his parents, who wanted him to stay, but Mormon loved living in Nihiku and wanted to make it his permanent home. Anyway, Mormon made his living working as a contractor in a construction business owned by Ralph Malayakini's brother-in-law. On the morning of Sunday, February 11th, the five men in this story were doing a construction job on a house when they made a spur-of-the-moment decision to go on a fishing trip. The area had spent the past few weeks dealing with lousy weather, but since this happened to be a clear and gorgeous sunny morning, the group of friends decided to take the day off and go out on the water. They went to the nearby town of Hana in order to borrow a boat from Ralph Malayakini's twin brother, Robert. It was a 17-foot fiberglass Boston whaler known as the Sarah Joe, named after the Malayakini brothers' parents. The group went to a general store to purchase some new spark plugs to install on the boat, as well as some beer, soft drinks, and snacks for their trip. They even invited the owner of the general store to join them, but he declined, a decision which ultimately wound up saving his life. The five men left Hana Bay at approximately 10 a.m. and went out in the Alanui-Haha Channel, but within a few hours, disaster would strike. At around 1 p.m., the winds unexpectedly changed direction and the sky became dark, which seemed to indicate that a storm was on the way. It wasn't long before a downpour of rain and gale-force winds hit the area. Peter Hanchett's father, John Hanchett, decided to go out on the water and search for the Sarah Joe, but was unable to find them, and the weather became considerably worse. The island would be ravaged by what residents described as the worst storm they'd seen in 50 years. The winds would blow at more than 40 miles per hour, and the waves in the Alanui-Haha Channel reached over 40 feet high. Hana was flooded, and a number of homes and businesses suffered serious damage. At around 5 p.m., a CB operator thought he heard a distress call from the Sarah Joe's radio, though it's been up for debate whether this call actually originated from them. Regardless, no further contact could be made with the boat, and it never returned to shore. The following morning, John Hanchin enlisted the help of a family friend named John Naughton, who happened to be a marine biologist, to go out onto the water and search for the Sarah Joe. They had no success finding them, and no one else from the island could recall having seen the boat. The Coast Guard would launch a massive search effort for the Sarah Joe, but unfortunately, since the five men never told anyone where exactly they were planning to go fishing, the Coast Guard had no idea where to start. Since their trip was a last-minute one, the group had also not brought along an emergency positioning indicator radio beacon, which could have sent off a frequency, making them relatively easy to find. And even though the exterior of the Sarah Joe was white, its floor was turquoise blue, matching the color of the ocean, and making the boat more difficult to spot from the air. Believe it or not, the Coast Guard actually attempted to utilize three Navy-trained spotter pigeons to assist them. The pigeons would fly over the search area inside a specialized bubble container attached to the bottom of a helicopter, and hopefully, they could use their sharp eyesight to spot objects in the water which humans might have trouble seeing. For instance, if they saw some orange items resembling a life jacket, they would peck on a buzzer to alert the search team inside the chopper. Well, this idea ended in disaster on the second day of the search, when the Coast Guard helicopter ran out of fuel because of a fuel gauge malfunction. They were forced to land in the ocean a mile and a half from land, and sadly, the spotter pigeons inside the bubble container wound up drowning. The Coast Guard spent 5 days covering 73,000 square miles, but could find no trace of the Sarah Joe or any of its missing crew members, so they decided to suspend the search. The five men's families were not happy with this decision, and believe that since the Sarah Joe was considered to be an unsinkable boat, the Coast Guard might have found it if they expanded their search even further. They managed to raise over $50,000 to finance their own search effort for the Sarah Joe, which lasted for an entire month, but still came up empty. Even when local residents spent weeks combing the beaches looking for wreckage or any evidence to suggest what happened to the missing boat, nothing was found. The crew's loved ones eventually came to terms with the fact that they were probably lost at sea forever and would never be found. However, on September 10, 1988, 9.5 years after the Sarah Joe went missing, there would be an unexpected development. A crew from the National Marine Fisheries Service were performing a natural diversity and protected area survey, which involved searching for wildlife in the Marshall Islands. The Marshall Islands are an island country located in the North Pacific Ocean, which is spread out over 29 coral atolls. In case you're not aware of what an atoll is, they are ring-shaped coral reefs which usually surround lagoons of water. The people involved in this survey have been hired by the Marshallese government to find a site for a wildlife sanctuary, and they eventually wound up on Taiangi Atoll, which is located over 2,300 miles southwest of Hawaii. Taiangi is made up of 10 islets, the largest of which is Sabila, at approximately 4.5 miles long and 334 yards wide. While the group was surveying Sabila, they came across the wreckage of a small boat which appeared to be a Boston whaler. It was found upright, and its bow and gunwale were heavily damaged, but its hull was still intact, which seemed to indicate the boat may have flipped over after crashing ashore. While many of the letters and numbers from the boat's registration number had faded away, they were able to make out that the first two letters were H and A, which showed that it had been originally registered in Hawaii. But the most surprising discovery was what appeared to be a makeshift shallow grave 60 yards away. It had been marked with a driftwood cross and a pile of coral rocks, and a human jawbone was protruding from the rocks. In an incredible coincidence, one of the men from the survey who discovered the boat was John Naughton, the same marine biologist who had helped Peter Hanchett's father search for the Sarah Joe the day after it originally went missing. When Naughton returned to Honolulu, he reported his discovery to the Coast Guard. After a check was run on the partial registration numbers from the wrecked Boston whaler, it was officially confirmed to be the Sarah Joe. The Coast Guard received approval from the Marshall Islands government to return to Taiangi with some forensic experts. They proceeded to excavate the grave and uncovered a partial human skeleton. After the jawbone was cross-checked with dental records, the victim was positively identified as Scott Mormon, one of the five missing crew members of the Sarah Joe. However, no trace of the other four crew members could be found. Examiners were unable to determine Mormon's cause of death or the exact time period he died, so it was unclear if Mormon was still alive when he reached Taiangi and who might have been responsible for his burial. A piece of fiberglass from the Sarah Joe had also been buried in the grave, which suggested that someone wanted Mormon's remains to be connected to the boat. But the most curious clue from the grave was a sheaf of paper. It measured 3 inches by 3 inches, was about 3/4 of an inch thick, and had been bound together by a piece of string. Small square pieces of tinfoil material were placed between each individual piece of paper, all of which were blank. Of course, none of the five men from the Sarah Joe were known to have possessed such an item when they left Maui. It turned out the driftwood cross had been assembled together by nails with an unusual cross-hatched pattern. A forensic examination was performed on the cross in an attempt to determine where the nails might have come from and what type of hammer was used, but it failed to turn up any answers. There was a lot of confusion about how or when the Sarah Joe made it to Taiangi. Since it was over 2,300 miles away from Hana, experts determined that the boat could have drifted there in approximately 3 months. Even if Mormon or any of the other missing crew members were still alive when the Sarah Joe arrived, they probably would not have survived very long, as Taiangi was not a habitable place. While it did have some vegetation, there was no fresh water or coconuts there. The nearest inhabited land was hundreds of miles away, and in fact Taiangi was so remote that during the late 1950s, it was surveyed as a potential site for nuclear weapons testing. But even though the Sarah Joe had been missing for nearly a decade, forensic studies seemed to suggest that Mormon's grave was only around 3 to 4 years old. In 1985, representatives from the United States Department of the Interior had actually traveled to Taiangi to perform a geological survey, and they apparently saw no sign of the Sarah Joe or the grave. If this claim was accurate, then where was the boat during the preceding 6 years, and who buried Mormon? While Mormon's remains were returned to his family in California, so he could finally get a proper burial and a memorial service honoring his life, the wreckage of the Sarah Joe was returned to its original owner, Ralph Malayakini's brother Robert, who still keeps it in his backyard to this very day. 5 Norfolk pine trees would also be planted in honor of the 5 men next to a cross in Hana, but the loved ones of the 4 crew members who were not found still wanted answers. They wound up raising over $20,000 to hire a private investigator named Steve Goodnow, and in June of 1989, he would travel to Taiangi alongside Robert Malayakini and Peter Hanchett's brother, Michael. Their expedition was also filmed by the crew of a Honolulu TV show called Let's Go Fishing. The group discovered some more human bones, including a tailbone and vertebra, a few yards away from the original gravesite, but it was eventually determined that they also belonged to Mormon. Near the grave, several oversized beer bottles were found which had labels for Kirin, a Japanese brand not ordinarily sold in Hawaii at that time, so it seemed likely the beer belonged to someone else who had frequented the island and had not been on board the Sarah Joe. The group also managed to find the Sarah Joe's outboard engine wedged in the coral reef underwater. Fortunately, there was still no trace of the other four missing crew members, but a memorial brass plaque, which had been put together by the residents of Hana, was erected as a shrine at Mormon's gravesite. During the trip, Steve Goodnow uncovered evidence to suggest that the grave and the Sarah Joe had been on Tiangi as early as 1987. It turned out that while in the midst of fishing negotiations with the Marshallese government that year, a Japanese fishing crew had reported finding the boat and grave on the islet, but no further investigation was done. Goodnow also spoke to a man who had been the chief engineer on a Marshallese patrol boat which had reported seeing an illegal Taiwanese fishing boat on Tiangi in October of 1987. When the engineer went on shore, he claimed that he came across the gravesite, but was so emotionally shaken by the experience that he did not tell anyone. In spite of this new information, Goodnow's expedition could not come up with any conclusive answers about when the Sarah Joe originally arrived on Tiangi and who buried Scott Mormon's remains. In October of 1989, the story would garner national attention when it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. But in the end, Peter Hanchett, Benjamin Kalama, Patrick Woosner, and Ralph Malayakini were never found, and after 40 years, the full story of what actually happened to the crew of the Sarah Joe remains unknown. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to thank Murderbook, the new true crime podcast hosted by best-selling author Michael Connelly, for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Returning to his roots as a journalist, Michael Connelly now presents Murderbook, a new true crime podcast in which he works with the very detectives who inform his novels and his hit television show, Bosch. Pieced together by actual wiretaps, witness interviews, court recordings, and detective recollections, Murderbook aims to explore real homicide cases not ordinarily covered by the mainstream media. The first season is titled The Telltale Bullet and dives into a 30-year-old Hollywood carjacking gone wrong that tests the limits of the American criminal justice system. But before his foray into podcasting, Michael Connelly published 32 novels and sold over 74 million books worldwide. His latest number one bestseller is Dark Sacred Night, where detectives Harry Bosch and Renee Ballard team up to investigate the murder of a 15-year-old female runaway. The Washington Post has called Dark Sacred Night darkly brilliant, ingenious, and frantically suspenseful. I have been a big fan of Mr. Connelly's writing ever since I read The Lincoln Lawyer many years ago, and have always enjoyed his work featuring one of his most iconic characters, Harry Bosch. So it was a special treat for the author to have Bosch join forces with his newest protagonist, Renee Ballard, who was recently introduced in his novel, The Late Show. The interplay between these two characters showcases Connelly's gift for writing smart dialogue for compelling characters. It's great that Connelly is translating his talents as a storyteller into the podcasting world with Murderbook, and it's great to see him explore some lesser-known true crime stories that I'm not familiar with. So you can find Dark Sacred Night wherever books are sold, and once again, be sure to check out Michael Connelly's new Murderbook podcast, which is available on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts, or you can go directly to murderbookpodcast.com. That's murderbookpodcast.com. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the episode. So this is one of those Unsolved Mysteries cases where I watched the segment when it originally aired on TV while I was still a kid, and it just blew my mind and I couldn't make heads or tails of what might have happened. However, now that I'm much older and wiser, this story isn't nearly as mysterious as it seemed at the time, and I can come up with a logical explanation to account for a lot of the things that happened, but there are still quite a few bizarre, unexplained elements. Like I mentioned in the intro, in cases where a boat full of people vanish without a trace, it's usually not hard to figure out what happened, especially when you're talking about an area as vast as the Pacific Ocean. The only other episode I've done on the podcast involving a missing boat was the disappearance of an Australian schooner named the Patinella, as there were enough bizarre details to suggest there was a lot more to that story than a boat simply sinking. If the Sarah Jo had simply disappeared in the middle of a violent storm and never returned, there wouldn't be that much to talk about, but the fact that the boat and a grave containing one of the crew members turned up on a remote atoll over 2,300 miles away opens up a lot of unanswered questions. This is one of those sad stories which might never have happened were it not for a few unfortunate twists of fate. The five crew members planned to spend the entire day working on a construction job, but then made a spontaneous decision to take the day off and go fishing because the weather was so beautiful. Today, any of those men could look up a weather report on their phone in 5 seconds and probably would have decided against the trip once they saw there was a violent storm on the horizon that afternoon. But back in 1979, the community of Hana did not even receive any television signals, let alone internet, and the radio stations they picked up generally only gave weather reports for the western side of Maui, since that's where the majority of the tourism occurred. The local residents essentially just used their eyes and their gut instinct to predict the weather, so if they were experiencing a beautiful sunny morning after weeks of rain and wind, they likely did not anticipate that the island would soon be hit by the worst storm they'd seen in 50 years. It's pretty striking when you look at photographs of the Sarah Jo and see how small it really is. Even in normal weather, it really doesn't look like it would be well equipped to carry 5 men, and it had no shelter whatsoever. So if they found themselves trapped in a terrible storm, it's very easy to see how some of these men could have fallen overboard and been lost at sea forever. Now, one detail I'm not entirely clear on is if the men brought life jackets on their trip. I'd assume not, but then again, the Coast Guard made a brief attempt to use pigeons to spot flashes of orange floating in the ocean. I know the Unsolved Mystery segment presented a reenactment of the 5 men leaving on the Sarah Jo, and none of them were shown wearing life jackets. While I can't vouch for its 100% accuracy, the early seasons of the show did attempt to make the details of the reenactments as close to the real thing as possible. Given that all these men were considered to be excellent swimmers, their trip was completely unplanned, and boating was just a standard way of life in Hana, I'm guessing they did not bring any life jackets with them. There's actually a half-hour documentary on YouTube titled The Sarah Jo, Hana Remembers Her Sons, which features interviews with some of the relatives of the missing men and residents of Hana, who provide a lot of backstory about the place and what it was like to live there back then. We know the crew purchased some beer, soft drinks, and snacks before they left on their trip, so they would have had some supplies to last them for a period of time, but not very long. And of course, since they were on a fishing trip, they could have conceivably caught fish for sustenance if they were stranded on the ocean, but that's only assuming the storm didn't capsize their boat and cause them to lose their equipment. What's interesting is that in spite of the vast search effort, not only was there no trace of the boat or the 5 men, but there was no sign of debris or anything else in the water to suggest they had been in an accident. That's why I think there's a good chance the storm blew the Sarah Jo outside the original search area into the Pacific Ocean before anyone started looking for them. There's just a big question about whether any of the crew members were still alive by that point, and how long they could have survived while they were out there. I have to say that I don't think it's very likely that Scott Moorman or any of the other men were still alive by the time the Sarah Jo reached Taiangi Atoll in the Marshall Islands. It was located over 2,300 miles away, and experts believed it would have taken a minimum of 3 months to drift there. And this was a 17-foot Boston Whaler with no shelter whatsoever and a very limited amount of supplies, so the chances of survival for that long seem pretty slim. It's also worth noting that Taiangi is considered to be one of the most uninhabitable atolls in the Marshall Islands due to the fact that there's no freshwater and virtually no food supply, and very little in the way of vegetation. Taongi is also very isolated from the rest of the atolls, and 170 miles northeast of the nearest one, so if you wind up stranded there, you are pretty much out of luck. But since Mormon's remains were found in a marked grave, I guess you can't entirely discount the possibility that at least one of his friends did manage to make it to Taongi in order to bury him. Or it's possible that Mormon made it there alone and died shortly thereafter, and some outsider who came across his remains at a later time decided to give him a proper burial. But if any of the other Sarajevo crew members were there, what happened to them? Well, regardless of whether anyone survived or not, I think the evidence clearly suggests that Mormon's grave was made by an outsider. The sheaf of paper found on the grave was not an item that anyone from the Sarajevo was known to have owned or brought on their fishing trip with them, so where did it come from? There's also the practicality of having the necessary supplies to construct the driftwood cross, which was assembled together by nails described as having an unusual cross-hatched pattern. I have my doubts that the men would have taken nails like this on a fishing trip, and in fact I don't think they would have possessed a hammer either. The prevalent theory is that when the Sarajevo got caught in the raging storm, it either tipped over, or most of the crew fell out of the boat, and drowned. Again, we're talking about a 17-foot boat which had 5 people cramped together inside of it, so I can't imagine it would have been very sturdy. While this has never been conclusively proven, it's possible that in response to seeing his friends drown in the ocean, Mormon tied himself to the boat. Even if he died shortly thereafter, being tied to the Sarajevo could have allowed him to remain inside the boat as it drifted through the Pacific Ocean for months before it ultimately washed ashore at Taongi. Of course, one of the biggest mysteries is when exactly the Sarajevo might have arrived there. The boat was discovered on Taongi 9.5 years after it disappeared, and there seemed to be multiple witnesses, including the crew of a Japanese fishing boat and the chief engineer of a Marshallese patrol boat, who reported seeing the Sarajevo and Mormon's grave there as early as 1987. But we cannot be certain if the Sarajevo or Mormon's remains arrived in Taongi before that, and the biggest complication in this story is the geological survey team who traveled to the atoll in 1985 and claimed nothing was there at that time. If this information is correct, where was the Sarajevo during the 6 years when its whereabouts are unaccounted for? Could it really have been floating around the Pacific Ocean for over half a decade with the skeletal remains of one of its crewmen inside? Well, as morbid as that scenario sounds, it's certainly not impossible. Now, I have to admit, I used to be pretty skeptical about the veracity of this claim that a U.S. government survey took place on Taongi, mostly because the primary source was Ralph Malayakini's brother during his interview on Unsolved Mysteries, and it kind of sounded like he had heard this information second or third hand. If this survey actually happened, I started to wonder if perhaps it took place on an entirely different islet, and the people involved were mistaken about the location, which is why they did not recall seeing the Sarajevo or the grave. Well, lo and behold, I was actually able to track down a copy of an official report about this geological survey online. It was published by the United States Department of the Interior, and the title is Geochemistry and Petrology of Basaltic Rocks from the Marshall Islands. And if you do a Google search, all 25 pages are available for your viewing pleasure in the database of the United States Government Survey website if you have a keen interest in basaltic rock. And this report does confirm that they visited Taongi sometime in 1985 in order to study poorly indurated limestone coquina of 4 Reef Slope Deposit. Incidentally, while we're on the subject, the actual report of the survey John Naughton was participating in when they found the Sarajevo in September of 1988 is also available online. It's titled, Report of the Northern Marshall Islands Natural Diversity and Protected Area Survey, and it's a whopping 140 pages long, so if you want to learn all about the ecology of Taongi, go nuts. Anyway, since Taongi is a lot of open space and only 334 yards wide, on the surface, you'd think it would be pretty difficult to miss the wreckage of a boat and a marked grave, but I must add the disclaimer that the report doesn't provide any specific details about where on Tiangi this geological survey took place, and what sections they might have explored. Remember, Tiangi has a total of 10 islets, and Sibilla, where the Sarah Joe washed up, happens to be the largest one. Could it be possible that the survey took place on one of the other islets? Even if it didn't, Sibilla is still 4.5 miles long, so the survey team could have gone ashore at a completely different spot than where the boat and the grave were located. But there's another possibility. Perhaps they did catch a glimpse of the Sarah Joe's wreckage, but the grave was not there yet. If the team didn't know the Sarah Joe's significance, they might not have paid it any attention and bothered to go check it out, so they were completely unaware that the skeletal remains of Scott Mormon were still inside the boat at that time. Someone else could have then visited Sibilla a year or two later, discovered Mormon's remains in the Sarah Joe, and then decided to bury him in a makeshift grave. So I guess it'll always be up for debate when exactly Mormon was buried, but the other big question is, who did it? Well, the most prominent theory is that the burial was done by someone who was not supposed to be on Tiangi to begin with, which is why they never reported their discovery. After all, it was not uncommon for boats to frequent the Marshall Islands in order to perform illegal fishing, which is why the government often sent patrol boats to search the ocean for them. Of course, the most questionable aspect of this theory is whether or not someone who was illegally frequenting this location would go to the trouble of doing something like this. If you were trespassing on an islet you weren't supposed to be at, and you happened to stumble upon some skeletal remains, wouldn't your first instinct be to get out of there as quickly as possible, rather than constructing a cross, preparing a makeshift grave, and giving the victim a proper burial? Well, just because someone is performing an illegal act does not mean they wouldn't have a conscience about things like this. While whoever buried Mormon probably had their reasons for not reporting it, there are hints that they wanted to make things easier for the next person who visited Tiangi and stumbled upon the grave. This might explain why Mormon's jawbone was left right out in the open on top of the pile of rocks. Another interesting detail is that a small piece of fiberglass from the Sarah Joe was also buried alongside the remains. I think this lends credence to the idea that they originally found the remains inside the boat and wanted the next person who found them to make the connection. Indeed, there has also been a lot of discussion about the cultural implications of how Mormon was buried, and if it might have been performed by someone from Japan, Taiwan, China, or even elsewhere in the Marshall Islands. We do know that Japanese and Taiwanese fishermen frequented Tiangi during this time period, illegally or otherwise, and beer bottles with labels for a Japanese brand were found in close proximity to the grave. However, it's not entirely clear if those beer bottles were there when the grave was originally discovered by John Naughton in the Coast Guard in September of 1988, and it seems like the first person who reported finding them was Steve Goodnow when he made his expedition to Tiangi in July of 1989. So it's possible that someone else could have visited the islet and left those bottles during that 10-month time period, and they did not belong to the people who originally buried Mormon. Of course, the most intriguing clue was the sheaf of paper found on top of the grave containing small square pieces of tinfoil. Many people have speculated that this might have been joss paper, which is commonly used at Chinese funerals. Joss paper is usually cut into small squares and decorated with gold and silver foil to represent what is often referred to as spirit money. This ritual is intended to provide the deceased with currency to use in the afterlife. Now, while this might support the idea that some Chinese individuals visited the islet, came across Mormon's remains and buried him, the one detail which goes against this theory is that joss paper is traditionally supposed to be burned at Chinese funerals, and the sheaf of paper found on the grave was not. However, this could be explained by the fact that perhaps whoever made the grave did not have any matches or materials needed for starting a fire at that time, which is why the joss paper was left there untouched. There's also been some debate about the driftwood cross which was erected. Even though the primary theory is that someone from Japan, Taiwan, or China buried Mormon, Christianity is not the majority religion in those countries, and it's estimated that only 2-4% of the residents practice it. But it's also worth mentioning that Christianity is the dominant religion in the Marshall Islands, which would lend credence to the idea that it may have been local residents who lived on one of the inhabited atolls or islands who were responsible for the burial. Well, in the aforementioned documentary, The Sarah Jo, Hannah Remembers Her Sons, John Naughton is interviewed, and he provides a very interesting theory to address the cross. While this detail isn't mentioned in any of the media accounts, Naughton says that there were actually traces of blonde hair found on the grave. He speculates that perhaps the presence of blonde hair gave whoever found Mormon's remains the impression that he was a Christian, so even if they were not practicing Christians themselves, they decided to erect a cross in order to honor the victim, and leaving joss paper on the grave was their way of acknowledging their own religion. Naughton acknowledged that even if the people who buried Mormon had their reasons for not reporting their discovery, it was still a very nice gesture to give him a proper burial and provide him with currency for the afterlife. We may never know the true motivations behind whoever decided to do this, but without the grave and the cross, it's likely that Scott Mormon's remains would never have been found and returned to his family. So this is one of those episodes where I won't be ending with my usual disclaimer about contacting the appropriate authorities, because unless the person or persons who buried Mormon decide to come forward after all these years, I'm not sure if anything else can be done. Whatever happened, it's extremely unlikely that there was foul play involved with Scott Mormon or any of the other missing men, so there's no crime to solve. Sadly, I believe Peter Hanchett, Benjamin Kalama, Patrick Woosner, and Ralph Malayakini were no longer on the Sarah Jo before it reached Hyangi. The remains are probably in the Pacific Ocean somewhere, and I'm not sure if they can ever be found. But at least their memories, as well as that of Scott Mormon, will still live on, and it sounds like the residents of Hana never forget to pay their respects to them. In the end, this story seems destined to remain a bizarre unsolved mystery, but ultimately, it's not hard to come up with a logical explanation for what probably happened here. Anyway, if you have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've already produced some exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. Last month, to commemorate us recently passing our third anniversary, I released a bonus episode in which I counted down and discussed my personal top 10 favorite episodes of The Trail Went Cold, and of course we've got another exclusive episode lined up sometime this month. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. And you may have heard that for the third consecutive year, I will be representing The Trail Went Cold by appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, being held at the Hilton Riverside Hotel in New Orleans from June 7th until the 9th. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, but haven't already done so, we have our own personalized promo code you can use in order to get 10% off a standard badge. So to receive your 10% discount, please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code COLD19. That's COLD19. In addition, I will also be appearing at another event, the True Crime Podcast Festival, being held at the Marriott Downtown Hotel in Chicago on July 13th. So to learn more information about this event and purchase tickets, feel free to visit their website at tcpf2019.com. That's tcpf2019.com. I would also like to take this moment to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon, and they are Emma W., Lorraine S., Holly S., and John R. Thank you all so much for your support. Also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. Need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. And incidentally, in case you haven't read the news on social media, The Trail Went Cold just won an award at the Canadian Podcasting Awards last month in the category Outstanding Main Title Theme Music for a Series. Yes, that means that Vince Nitro is now officially an award-winning composer, so big congratulations to him. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for another new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.